This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening and welcome to Monday. It's a pretty chilly one in a lot of places around the country this Thanksgiving week. This hour, we're going to look at air travel from a couple of perspectives. We'll mark some sad days on the calendar with a discussion of the real people behind some statistics on gun violence in America. We'll have a look back 35 years at the environmental story that inspired the creation of the EPA Superfund program, Love Canal. And we'll have a moment of catharsis for the people of Dallas, a musical parting shot to a half century of grief. But we begin with a warming trend in the relationship between the U.S. and Iran.
The burden is on Iran to prove to the world that its nuclear program will be exclusively for peaceful purposes.
President Obama speaking about a deal to halt Iran's nuclear program and to begin talks on a much more complicated monitoring arrangement to see if Iran can prove that its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes.
Now the really hard part begins, and that is the effort to get the comprehensive agreement, which will require enormous steps in terms of verification, transparency, and accountability.
An historic deal, but a very long road ahead, according to Secretary of State John Kerry. Even a sustained conversation between the U.S. and Iran would be history-making, going back to the 1979 Islamic Revolution. But it's the forward motion that really matters here. Can the U.S. and Iran establish talks that could develop real momentum for skeptics in the international community? There are many people with long experience observing Iran's questionable intent about its nuclear program, which can also sound like strident saber-rattling at times. We'll hear from two of them now. Mark Fitzpatrick is with the London-based International Institute for Strategic Studies, but he spent years at the U.S. State Department as former Deputy Assistant Secretary for Nonproliferation. Fitzpatrick says the burden of proof question is a high bar. This will be no quick test for Iran to pass.
To prove that the program is strictly for peaceful purposes would take several years. It would take Iran to accept a more intrusive IAEA verification mechanism called the Additional Protocol, and the IAEA, over the course of several years, would have to be able to draw conclusions. There would have to be an absence of any further indications of nuclear weapons-related work and so forth. It would be a long process.
Is there precedent for satisfying this burden of proof? And that really gets to what John Kerry was talking about. Enormous steps in terms of verification, transparency, and accountability. I mean, there's essentially going to be, it's going to be open season in Iran in terms of inspectors.
Not quite open season, but the amount of inspection is going to increase significantly. Iran being willing to accept inspections on a daily basis at their major nuclear programs, allowing inspectors to visit workshops for centrifuge production and assembly. Those kind of visits go above and beyond what is normally required of parties to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Is there precedent? Yes, there is a precedent in some other countries who have abandoned nuclear weapons pursuits. South Africa is the best example of that. But the difference, of course, is that South Africa actually produced nuclear weapons. Iran has not. Plus, South Africa had a regime change. Iran has not. And I'm not sure that Iran has yet made a strategic change of policy. What they've done is accepted more transparency measures and some very significant limits on the program. But, you know, they're not abandoning it by any means.
And there's also the Libyan example of giving up a nuclear program just sort of unilaterally. And again, there are important differences between what Libya did and what Iran is envisioned to do here. When you say it's going to take years, who's going to have to really hold on and trust that there is a process in place that at the end of which we'll be able to say whether Iran is serious or not? What nations, what institutions, what constituencies within the United States?
Well, trust is, of course, all going to be based on the verification. And luckily, there is a highly respected, highly professional UN body, probably the most professional, the most highly respected of the UN bodies, the International Atomic Energy Agency, will be continuing and heightening its inspection processes in Iran. On top of that, nations, particularly the United States, Israel, France, Great Britain, Germany, have a lot of intelligence agency attention to what's going on in Iran. If Iran were to violate any aspects of this interim deal, I'm pretty sure that both through those intelligence agencies and the inspections of the IAEA, that we'd know about it pretty soon.
Is there a such thing as a national right to enrich uranium for any reason in the world? Has the international community ever recognized such a right?
There's a huge debate over the right to enrichment. The NPT does not explicitly talk about a right to enrichment, but it implicitly does. I think you can read through the lines. At least that's my assessment. Most of the countries of the world go along with the view that the NPT does accord a right to enrichment because it doesn't prohibit it, and it talks about the right to peaceful uses of nuclear energy. But the United States, United Kingdom, France, and one other country don't agree with that. So there remains a legal dispute. And in this interim deal in Geneva, the parties agreed to fudge that difference by interpreting the treaty differently.
The Non-Proliferation Treaty, that's the NPT, that's referred to there by Mark Fitzpatrick, former Deputy Assistant Secretary for Non-Proliferation at the U.S. State Department. Thanks so much.
Sure. Happy to talk to you, John.
Picking up on this question of whether Iran or any nation, for that matter, has a right to enrich uranium for any purpose, that issue was quite apparent, and the divergent views among the parties also quite evident in statements over the weekend. Here's Secretary of State John Kerry.
This first step does not say that Iran has a right to enrichment. No matter what interpretive comments are made, it is not in this document.
But what does Iran say about that? Is it in the document, a right to enrich?
It says very clearly that Iran will have an enrichment program and it has a right to nuclear technology for peaceful purposes.
That is Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif speaking on NBC News. Is this a contradiction, some sign that these talks are headed nowhere, or one of the deliberate ambiguities that diplomats put into agreements that allows both parties to claim victory as the difficult bargaining begins? We pick that up, that issue up now with Gary Sick, senior research scholar at Columbia University's Middle East Institute, author of All Fall Down, America's Tragic Encounter with Iran. Gary Sick, welcome.
It's good to be with you again.
So do you think this ambiguity is deliberate or a sign that, we're getting into an argument right off the bat?
No, it's deliberate. Everybody knew at the beginning that Iran would insist absolutely on having the right to enrich uranium on its own soil. And you can argue about the technicalities of that, but Iran was not going to do a deal unless they had that. We, the U.S. and some others, didn't want to say that explicitly, and so they've come up with a formula that, in fact, lets both sides interpret it their own way. That takes care of everybody's problems, and basically it isn't an issue. It will be more of an issue later on when you go past the next 6 months and we come to the negotiations of a comprehensive treaty, then a comprehensive agreement with Iran. Then that issue may become more binding. But even then, if you look at back when Nixon's opening to China, they had the Shanghai Declaration in which the United States and China each took opposite positions and said they agree to disagree and left it at that. And that didn't stop the agreement from going through.
And the opening to China was preceded by a lot of secret negotiations. And indeed, we learned that this agreement was preceded by a lot of secret negotiations between U.S. officials and Iranian officials. What do you make of those reports?
Well, I believe we talked some months ago originally about this when the idea of looked like it was the possibility of some kind of an agreement with Iran was beginning to emerge. And my advice at that time was we needed secret agreements. we needed secret contacts because we wanted to get some assurances on both sides before you actually get into the negotiating process itself. You want assurances from either side that they're really serious about this, they're prepared to go through, and to get some sense of what they're prepared to put on the table. I think that was accomplished. The actual negotiation was done out in the open. It was done by the P5 plus one, the group that actually did the negotiation. But having that initial contact between the United States and Iran provided assurances on both sides that they were actually serious about this and that a deal could in fact be struck. That was very important.
From the perspective of Iran's domestic politics, what constituencies are going to have to hold the line and really maintain a consistent sort of message on non-proliferation if this deal is going to go anywhere inside Iran?
Well, we're seeing the forces line up in Iran already. There were people who were very unhappy with the agreement, the way it came out, made clear that they were. On the other hand, there were cheering crowds that greeted the foreign minister as he arrived back in Tehran, and the supreme leader and President Rouhani, the new president of Iran, exchanged letters in which they were congratulatory toward the people who had done the negotiation, and it in effect blessed the deal as far as the supreme leader was concerned. So basically, the Iran has choreographed this rather carefully internally to avoid the problems that they had in the past, where they cut a deal too quickly and the supreme leader didn't like it or some other party didn't like it. The Revolutionary Guard, which is the most important single institution in Iran, has not really spoken on this subject. They've kept very quiet, and basically that's a very good sign.
I'm speaking with Gary Six, senior research scholar at Columbia University's Middle East Institute. The Israelis have said very openly, Bibi Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, has said openly it's a more dangerous world because of this agreement. Is there any bar that Iran could reach on this question of a nuclear program, do you think, that would satisfy Israel?
Well, first of all, the people who are really criticizing it most strongly, I think it's very, very clear, they don't want a deal at all. They really want a gun held to the head of Iran. They want Iran to be isolated from the rest of the world and cut off, and that unable to play a role in international politics. That is the real objective. If you look at it purely in terms of the nuclear side, look at what Netanyahu said to the UN when he held up that famous cartoon and drew a red line. Basically, what Iran is proposing right now and what the agreement calls for is within the next 6 months, instead of being approaching that red line that Netanyahu was talking about, it will disappear completely. That the threat that he was holding out of what could possibly happen in 2014 and possibly require a war, actually will disappear completely. That entire threat that he talked about at the UN. You don't hear him mentioning that. But the reality is that this does resolve many, if not most, of the issues that were regarded as the most threatening things that Israel faced as far as the nuclear program was concerned. So, I take with a very big grain of salt the opposition that has been raised. The opposition really says it's an agreement, but it's not perfect. It doesn't do everything we would like to have it do. Therefore, it's no good at all. And that's not a legitimate point of view.
And we will see if momentum can be developed over the next 6 months as the serious negotiations begin. Gary Six, senior research fellow at Columbia University's Middle East Institute, author of All Fall Down, America's Tragic Encounter with Iran. Thanks so much, Gary.
Good to talk to you.
So stay with us. Tell us your story. Respond to anything on the program at 877-8-MY-TAKE.